On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training on biofuels, release prevention, environmental behavior, and remediation. Today's training was developed by the ITRC biofuels team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to quickly cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC biofuels team. Today's training course is based on the technical and regulatory guidance document, Biofuels, Release Prevention, Environmental Behavior, and Remediation. Today's training is an introduction to the document, and we do encourage you to review the document itself. We're going to take you to a link at the end of the training class where you can access a PDF of the guidance. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during today's training. In addition to what you see on the slides, there's more information in the notes section of the downloaded version. And at the end of the training, we'll take you to the link where you can download a PowerPoint or a PDF of the presentation. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. Moving to slide two, if you're unfamiliar with this version of CLUIN, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you're going to use the third button, the single right arrow. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner. Trainers are going to say the slide number throughout today's training. Each of you in the audience is in control of your own slides. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end. For our phone line audience, we ask you to keep your phone on mute until those question and answer breaks, and at that point, you're welcome to unmute and ask questions out loud. For the simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark at the top of the slide that allows you to send in questions. Anyone, phone line and simulcast participants, is welcome to send in questions at any time during today's training using that orange question mark button. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the information. Today's class is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC classes. We have over 50 archives of ITRC classes, and CLUIN also supports others giving training, so there are hundreds of archives available, so I encourage you to check the archives for topics of interest. On slide three, ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, it's a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website, which we list here on the slide. There's other technical and regulatory guidance documents. We have classroom and internet-based training. I do encourage you to review the ITRC website. On slide four, I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC biofuels team. Mike Madigan is an environmental chemist with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection in Harrisburg. He provides technical support for the administration of Pennsylvania Voluntary Cleanup Program and has performed human health and ecological risk assessment reviews in support of remediation projects throughout Pennsylvania. Dr. David Tao is a technical specialist with BP's Remediation Engineering and Technology Group in Naperville, Illinois. He leads BP's evaluation of potential environmental impacts of current and future biofuels. He also provides technical support by developing site conceptual models, selecting appropriate remedies, and optimizing the performance of engineered remediation systems. Dr. Denise Nelson is a principal remediation engineer with Arcadis US in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She focuses on the application and optimization of injection-based bioremediation technologies, including enhanced reductive dechlorination, anaerobic biological oxidation of petroleum hydrocarbons, metals precipitation, and explosives remediation. Mark Tuso is a hydrogeologist in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in St. Paul. His responsibilities include technical oversight of investigation and remediation at petroleum and chemical storage tank facilities, biofuels protection facilities, RCRA and Superfund sites, and pipeline releases. He also provides technical assistance for the Emergency Response Program. On slide five, I'm now going to turn today's presentation over to Mike Madigan, of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Mike?
Okay, thanks, Juliana. Hopefully everyone can hear me well. I'm using a headset that I'm not sure how well the battery is going to last, but if you can't hear me, just let me know, and I'll switch to the handset. Okay, so we're moving on to slide five right now. So when we talk about biofuels, the issues that usually come to mind are things like energy use, global warming, sustainability, and these are all big picture issues. And while they're still important, what often gets overlooked is the direct impact of biofuel releases on the environment. And that's what we're going to talk about today in the training. In the United States, federal and state mandates have been used to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, which has caused an increase in biofuel manufacturing and use. I know that when I got involved with the ITRC biofuels team, Pennsylvania was considering developing a cleanup standard for ethanol. But I knew that before we could really think about developing an ethanol standard, we needed to get a much better understanding of the specific issues regarding biofuel releases themselves. Things like, what are biofuels and why are they important? Are there equipment compatibility issues associated with biofuels? And how do biofuel releases really impact the environment? Do biofuels behave differently in the environment than your basic petroleum-based fuels? And how should biofuel releases be cleaned up? Well, I'm sure a lot of you are dealing with similar issues in your state, which is why you're taking today's training. So we're going to discuss those questions, so hopefully you'll be able to leave the training today a little more prepared to effectively deal with your biofuel releases. All right, let's go ahead and move to slide six. All right, so after completing today's training, you're going to have a better understanding of biofuel use, biofuel production, and how biofuels are different from petroleum-based fuels. You also have a much better understanding and be better equipped to use the ITRC biofuels document whenever you're investigating or remediating these biofuel releases. So that is our goal for today's training. So let's now move on to slide seven. Okay, so this is our training roadmap, and you'll see these slides as we change topics during the day. First, I'm going to go through the basics of biofuels and how the ITRC biofuels document is assembled and put together when we wrote it. Then we're going to discuss biofuel releases, how they move through the environment, and then how spills should be cleaned up. And we'll also have two question and answer sessions, one midway through the training and then another one at the end. You're also going to see a red star on certain slides, like the one you see at the bottom of slide seven. This star indicates that we're talking about a hypothetical case study that we've developed to help illustrate some key points. So let's go on to slide eight. And this is what our hypothetical case study looks like. And we're going to be sort of building on it as we progress through the training today. So as you can see, it's a small commercial dispensing station with a USD that is leaking fuel ethanol. Now, keep in mind that this illustration isn't really to scale, but you can assume that the beta zone is fairly shallow here. But we'll be using this case study as a means to illustrate how and why biofuel releases occur and how these materials move throughout the environment. Okay, let's move to slide nine. Okay, so the word biofuels, I mean, it's a really general term that refers to really any kind of fuel created from biomass, including solids and gases. Examples would include wood pellets, that's a solid form of biofuel, and a biofuel gas would be something like landfill gas. But biofuels is defined differently depending on who you ask, but for the purposes of this training, the term biofuels is applied to liquid fuels and blending components produced from renewable biomass feedstocks used as alternative or supplemental fuels for internal combustion engines. So when we say biofuels today, that's what we're talking about. Okay, let's go on to slide 10. Okay, so I want to go over a few important terms that we're going to be using, and we'll use these a lot throughout the training today. I'm sure a lot of you know what these terms mean and are familiar with them, but for some people that may be new, I wanted to take a minute to go over them. The first is denatured fuel ethanol, or DFE, and this is fuel ethanol made unfit for beverage use by the addition of a denaturant. The term DFE and E95 we use interchangeably. Denaturants can vary internationally, but in the U.S., the denaturant in fuel ethanol is almost always a gasoline-based product. The next one is FAME, or fatty acid monoalkyl or methyl esters. These are transesterified oils derived from vegetable oils or animal fats, blended with or used in place of the conventional diesel fuels. So FAME essentially represents the bio part of biodiesel. The next one is biofuel blend. This is a mixture of biofuel and conventional petroleum-based fuel. So it's important to note that the focus of the ITRC biofuels document and this training is on the blends with the highest biofuels component. And then the last one is conventional fuel, which is a mixture of hydrocarbons refined from petroleum crude plus additives to improve its stability, control deposit formations in engines, and modify other characteristics. So when we say conventional fuels, we're simply referring to petroleum-based fuels. And again, for the purpose of this training and this document, E10 is considered to be a conventional fuel, even though it does have an ethanol component. E10 has a very low biofuel component, so it really behaves the same way in the environment as a pure hydrocarbon fuel would. And again, this document focuses just on the higher percentage biofuel blends. So we'll be using some other terms in the training that may be new to some of you, but we just wanted to go over these four terms because we'll be using them a lot today. Okay, let's move on to slide 11. Most biofuel is transported via rail because biofuel pipelines just haven't been built yet. So as a result, train derailments are really the most common cause of releases. Each rail car contains between 25 and 30,000 gallons of biofuel, and with trains of up to 100 rail cars long, a derailment it can be pretty catastrophic. You can see in these pictures, they're from a Rockford, Illinois release in 2009, where 75,000 gallons of E95 was released to soil and to the Rock River in a train derailment. And that's after 360,000 gallons was consumed by fire immediately following the release. So over 80% of the total release burned and never reached the soil or the river. But still, that release to the river is thought to be responsible for impacting more than 50 miles of the Rock River, including over 70,000 fish deaths. So a lot of it burned, but it still had some pretty substantial impacts on the environment. And this is just one of several biofuel release case studies that are discussed in detail in the biofuels document. So for more detail on this specific incident, you can go to the document itself to get more information. Now, not all biofuel spills are this dramatic. There are subtle releases, such as slow underground leaks, that can go undetected for long periods of time, but because of that, still result in a very large overall release. Sometimes slow releases are detected when a nearby petroleum release investigation is being impacted and things are not going the way they expect, and it's because of the biofuel impact. And these slow, undetected leaks can be caused by things like faulty valves, loose pipe connections, or improper maintenance. So, and those are things we're going to talk about in detail today. So let's go on to slide 12. So another big reason that we're concerned with biofuel releases is that they behave differently than petroleum in the environment. Now, I'm sure that those of you who work with petroleum releases on a regular basis are familiar with how they move through the subsurface, but biofuels have different characteristics than petroleum-based fuels. So things like site characterization and remediation are going to be different for biofuel releases, and we'll go into the specifics of those strategies in today's training. Now, the previous slide showed the immediate safety risks of biofuel releases. But there can also be safety risks associated with the investigation phase of a biofuel cleanup. For example, methane generation at biofuel sites can pose an explosion risk for drill rig operators, where that's typically not a big concern at petroleum sites. Another major difference is that most petroleum is transported via pipeline, while the majority of biofuels are currently transported via truck or rail. So this really increases the handling of biofuels, and it makes it much more likely for a release to occur. And just as a side note, for those that are interested in learning more about petroleum releases, IPRC is still offering a two-day LNAPL classroom training in October. I believe it's October 29th and 30th in Richmond, Virginia. You can check the ITRC website for more details on that, and I believe that Juliana will be giving you some links at the end of the training for how to register for that course. So, anyway, so the three main reasons why we really need a good understanding of biofuel releases is, one, the potential of catastrophic releases, two, the potential for slow, undetected releases, and three, their substantial differences between the characteristics of biofuels and petroleum fuels. Okay, so let's go to slide 13. So what's really driving all this biofuel production? Well, it's mainly due to government mandates. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 and the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 are the two main laws in the United States that mandate biofuel production and use. And you can see in this slide that these mandates bumped U.S. production goals from 7.5 billion gallons in 2012 to 36 billion gallons in 2022. So these government mandates produce or force production increases, which will likely lead to an increase in biofuel releases. So, you know, these government mandates also address other biofuels, but really for the purposes of this document, we're going to focus on ethanol and biodiesel. So let's now go to slide 14. So it's not just the federal government that's instituting these mandates. As of 2011, these 11 states here indicated in green have implemented their own biofuel mandates, although Massachusetts suspended their mandate in 2012, and I believe Florida suspended their mandates last year in 2013. And the state mandates include things like retailer incentives, labeling requirements, fleet fuel requirements, that sort of thing. And there's more information on this in the biofuels document itself. Let's move on to slide 15. There are also international mandates in use in places like the EU and in Brazil. In fact, Brazil has had biofuel use requirements in place since the mid-1970s, although I believe that Brazil's fuel ethanol is sugarcane-based, while in the U.S. it is corn-based. But yes, there are international mandates as well. So let's move to slide 16. Okay, so this training is based on the ICRC document, Biofuels, Release Prevention, Environmental Behavior, and Remediation. And this document was released in September 2011, so hopefully everyone has been using it since then. But this slide shows each of the sections in the document, and we'll be covering all of these topics in the training today. But I want to note that although stakeholder concerns has its own section in the document, when we discuss these concerns today, it will be as they relate to each of the other sections. So we're not going to talk about just stakeholder concerns on their own. Also, all of the figure and the table references that we use in the training today refer to the actual figure and table numbers in the document itself. Okay, let's go to slide 17. So it's important to note that this is not an all-encompassing biofuels document, which I was talking about earlier. It really focuses on fuel ethanol and biodiesel and what their impacts are on the environment. And we decided to focus on fuel ethanol and biodiesel simply because they're really currently the most widely used and commercially available biofuels on the market today. I know that biobutanol is mentioned in the document, but it's really not discussed in detail because it's not quite as prevalent as the others. You'll also notice that fuel additives are not addressed in the document. And the reason for that is that the only additive to fuel ethanol is the denaturant, which is almost always gasoline-based. So we didn't feel we needed to discuss that in detail. For biodiesel, there are lots of different biodiesel additives, but we discovered that there's really very little research out there on them, so it was really difficult for us to put any kind of useful discussion together on biodiesel additives. So that's why we don't discuss them. However, we did decide to use a multimedia evaluation process as the framework to develop the document because it can be applied to additives and other emerging biofuels that you'll see in the future. And we used this approach so the document would still be applicable as other biofuels emerge. So we'll talk more about that in just a minute. But let's right now let's move on to slide 18. Okay, so in these next few slides, we're going to discuss how the document is intended to be used. You know, it's pretty obvious that the best way to deal with a biofuel release is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And this can be done by ensuring materials compatibility and updating your best management practices. And this document can help a lot with those decisions. The document can also be used for release response planning. It's always important to have up-to-date emergency response procedures in place so that an effective response can be launched in the event of a release. Okay, so let's go to slide 19. All right, so regardless of how prepared we are, biofuels releases are inevitable. So it's good to have an idea of how to investigate these releases once they occur. As I mentioned a couple slides ago, the physical, chemical, and biological properties of biofuels are different from conventional fuels. So when you're characterizing a site, the biofuels document can be used to help set up a sampling plan or in developing a conceptual site model that's appropriate for biofuels. There's also detailed information in the document to help guide you through the process of determining long-term response strategies and evaluating stakeholder concerns regarding any lingering environmental impacts. Now, like I said before, this document uses a multimedia approach, and this can be applied to other biofuels as they become more widely used. The multimedia approach evaluates the potential impacts of a release of a given fuel or fuel additive and assesses how contaminants may interact with natural resources within different environmental media. So we used this approach so that the document would still be applicable to a wide variety of biofuels as they become available in the future. And there's a lot more detail on that in the document itself. Okay, so let's move on to slide 20. So this table shows the different types of ethanol blends that are currently in use and what the names mean. The E number generally represents the percentage of fuel ethanol in the blend. So, for example, according to ASTM, E85 is a blend of ethanol and gasoline consisting of 70% to 85% by volume denatured fuel ethanol. The term neat ethanol, or E100, refers to ethanol that has not been denatured. And if you go to slide 21, you'll see the same naming convention applies to biodiesel, but obviously they used the letter B instead of an E. So ASTM defines B5 to B20 as a blend of petroleum-based diesel and biodiesel that contains between 6 to 20% biodiesel. And similar to ethanol, neat biodiesel or B100 refers to biodiesel that has not been blended with petroleum itself. So let's go to slide 22. So over the past decade, government mandates and improvements in technology have led to an increase in biofuel production all throughout the world. It's likely that ethanol and biodiesel production will maintain that trend in the next decade. And these graphs show that worldwide production of ethanol is expected to increase by about 80%. In the next 10 years, and biodiesel is expected to increase by about 65%. So production will keep rising due to government mandates. If we go to slide 23, talk about some opportunities to use this document. There are lots of ways that the ITRC biofuels document can be used along with your state's guidance documents. For example, if you're trying to set up an indoor air sampling program for a biofuels release, you can use the ITRC biofuels document along with your state's vapor intrusion guidance for determining how to conduct your sampling or to put together a conceptual site model. If you're in industry, the biofuels document can be used with your facility's emergency response plans to determine first response procedures in the event of a biofuel release. The biofuels document can also be used together with other ITRC documents, such as the two vapor intrusion guidance documents that were published in 2007. Okay, let's move on to slide 24. All right, so we've talked about why biofuels are important and why their production is increasing. And like I said before, the word biofuels brings up a whole host of questions and opinions regarding lots of politically charged topics, but this training doesn't discuss any of that. What we're going to focus on is the direct impact of biofuel releases on the environment. So, up next is Dr. David Tsao. David is a chemical engineer with BP, and he will be discussing biofuel release prevention and response planning. All right, David, it's all yours.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Why don't we move to slide 25, and this is sort of the overview of what I'll talk about in terms of biofuel releases, which is covered in section 2 of our document. And really what we're focusing in on are a series of case studies that we've used as to sort of form the basis of this, the information in this section, looking at what kind of scenarios have we seen in terms of biofuel releases and how frequently are we seeing them. You know, so it gets to the idea of, you know, we've got a series of case studies that we can look at. You know, what are the causes? What's happening that cause these releases? And then ultimately, like Mike had mentioned, the best way to deal with this is hopefully get ahead of the game and try to prevent these from occurring in the future by looking at, again, what have we learned from these case studies to say, okay, this is the reason why they're happening. Can we do something now to prevent them? And then ultimately, you know, if there's any changes that we need to make, if there is a release, how do you immediately respond to it in an emergency response plan? And what kind of things do you need to consider knowing that the behavior of these biofuels is going to be different than what most of the response plans are based on, which is the petroleum side of things? So if there is a different behavior, how are you going to respond differently to accommodate for that? So moving on to slide 26, you know, the way we developed this particular section of the document was all around how the supply chain occurs for both the petroleum side as well as the biofuel itself. So what you're seeing on slide 26 is really a combined figure from the document, figures 2-1 and 2-2, and it's an attempt to illustrate what the differences are in the supply chain for the bulk petroleum, and then the bulk biofuel that is then used to blend together at, say, the bulk depot or supply terminal, which is in that center of that figure, and then transported the blended fuel to the dispensing station on the right of the slide. So the differences between those are really shown with the green background. So on the petroleum side, you have a refinery, of course, that is transporting bulk petroleum before it's blended with the biofuel in a pipeline to that supply terminal. On the other hand, for the biofuel supply chain, you have a manufacturing facility. These are generally going to be in your agricultural centers around the country, you know, so in the Midwest or in different parts of, where different agriculture is being done. You have that manufacturing facility, but typically there, like Mike had mentioned, there aren't pipelines that are transporting that bulk biofuel to the supply terminal where it's, again, blended with the bulk petroleum to create the fuel that's actually put into sent to the dispensing station. And the main transport mechanism for the bulk biofuel is really by rail car, but there's also truck transport and barge transport that occurs as well. It's not meant to say that petroleum is not transported, you know, in these modes as well, but the majority is actually transported through pipeline for the petroleum side. And the majority of the biofuels is actually transported through, you know, through rail, truck, and barge. And just to give some scale on how much, you know, material is moving through the biofuel supply chain. Based on 2010 data, there's about 1 million barrels of fuel ethanol or denatured fuel ethanol moving through rail, truck, or barge per day to the bulk or supply terminal. And for biodiesel, if you're assuming it's a B5 fuel, it's about 200,000 barrels of biodiesel per day moving through the supply chain. So we're talking fairly large volumes of it. And as Mike also had mentioned, you know, these are in very discrete packages of fuel. So one tank car, you know, has, you know, 25 to 30,000 gallons in it. So moving on to slide 27, how we start talking about the release scenarios and incidents in this document is covered in section 2.1. And really the heart of that section is a table, table 2-1. And what you see on slide 27 is really just a small excerpt of that table. So basically we took every point in the supply chain on the previous slide and broke out, okay, what kind of volumes are we dealing with in that point in the supply chain? What kind of release frequency are we seeing, or incident frequency are we seeing in that point of the supply chain? What's on slide 27 is very specific to that transport piece where rail cars, tanker trucks, and barges are the release point. So what kind of volumes are we talking about? We've already mentioned the rail cars, you know, 25 to 30,000 gallons, but you can have very large trains of it. So like that Rockford, Illinois site that was mentioned previously, you know, several rail cars actually, broke open in that case. Large fire consumed a lot of the biofuel, the ethanol in that case, but a lot of it ended up on the ground, more so than one tank car. Similarly, tanker trucks are about 8,000 to 10,000 gallons per truck, and then tank barges are, you know, 420 to 360,000 gallons per barge. It's typical numbers for those. On the right side of this slide, on table 2.1 also, we do have some statistics, if you will. We went to sources like the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, Department of Transportation, or DOT, and tried to get some ideas how frequently are these incidences occurring. And, you know, the numbers that are shown here, so 2,000 derailments per year, although in that case the severity was not specified, it may not have actually led to a major, you know, loss of every, you know, of the contents of a rail car. But there are 2,000 derailments per year, and that's actually been fairly consistent over approximately a 10-year time frame. So that seemed to be a pretty solid number to go by and say, okay, how many tank cars do we have out there, and how often are these potentially derailing? A recent publication by the DOT actually listed an estimate of the tank cars hauling ethanol at about 30,000 tank cars in this country alone, moving denatured fuel ethanol around the country right now. And then similarly for tanker trucks, which, you know, rail cars and tank trucks are probably the two primary means of moving biofuels, there's about 1,000 road accidents per year involving transporting hazardous materials, including denatured fuel ethanol or E100 or blended biofuels as well. So, you know, and again, that statistic from the DOT is fairly constant over a 10-year time frame. So, again, pretty solid number to think about. So 1,000 road accidents per year, that's roughly 3 per day. You know, so think about it in that term. So today there are 3 tanker trucks, out on the road that could have an accident carrying biofuels. Now, the bottom of slide 27, we tried to capture, okay, what does this really mean in terms of the number of transport mechanisms that are out there today. So if you were to take all the bulk gasoline, so the petroleum component of that, the bulk diesel, and assume that it was used to create E10 or B5 respectively, how many tanker trucks or how many barges or how many rail cars would you need of biofuel in order to make E10 and B5? And so the numbers would be about 1,250 tanker trucks per day carrying bulk biofuels in order to create that E10 and B5. And same thing, 415 rail cars or 20 tank barges. So the numbers are pretty significant in terms of, you know, these small packages of bulk biodiesel or biofuel moving around in the infrastructure, potentially having accidents at these incident frequency rates that we show in the table 2-1. So moving up to slide 28, you know, obviously when you have a tank, you know, a train car derailment, the release cause is pretty obvious. But as Mike had mentioned, there's also some very subtle ways of having releases as well, particularly at the dispensing station itself. And Section 2.2 of the document really tries to cover those causes. And in this case, again, the heart of that section is really a table, Table 2-2, which covers leak detection issues, the release causes that we're seeing in a lot of these case studies. And again, slide 28 is just an excerpt of that. In this case, looking at a single point in the supply chain, the dispensing station, and what kind of equipment is associated with the dispensing station. So a USD system, the product piping, and a dispenser are associated typically with dispensing stations. And in this particular table, we break out the causes of the releases based on the type of equipment. So, you know, in other parts of this table, you might have above ground storage tanks, which can be present at both the supply terminal as well as the manufacturing facility. So the release causes are going to be the same regardless of where it is in the supply chain, but we break it out by the piece of equipment in this table just so that you can identify, okay, if I've got this, you know, underground storage tank system at my site, these are some of the typical causes that, of releases that occur. And these things can be, based on, you know, can you detect the release? So is it, these are typically going to be small volume releases compared to a catastrophic tank car release. But, is it going to be caught by your leak detection equipment that's, usually present in the USD system? And in many cases, these leak detection systems weren't originally designed to be compatible with water-soluble, ethanol in this case, or other components of biofuel. So they may not be compatible to be able to detect the rate of release occurring with the biofuel component as opposed to the petroleum, which is what they were actually designed for, and so forth. I should mention that this slide does have a red star, meaning it does have some relevance to our hypothetical case study that we'll get into, mainly looking at, okay, in this case, one of the things that can occur is if you've got an old underground storage tank that used to store regular conventional petroleum fuel, particularly if it's a metal, a metal-based tank, it can, have some weak points, some corrosion points that form. And oftentimes there's a lot of sludge and sediment that builds up in that corrosion point that actually holds the integrity of that tank for a while. But when you put in a high concentration ethanol fuel, for example, it may scour out that because ethanol is a much better solvent than petroleum is, and it can actually scour out that weak point, that is actually held together by some sludge and sediment. And once it's scoured out, it actually leads to a catastrophic release from that tank. And that is actually the scenario that we'll talk about as, a hypothetical case study. So moving on to slide 29, as I've mentioned before, we do have a series of case studies that we base, a lot of this document on. And those case studies are captured in an appendix, Appendix D of this document. What you see on slide 29 is an excerpt of another table, Table D-2 in this case. And it's really covering, the list of what sites are we talking about, what kind of fuel is present, that was actually released in these case studies, what was the estimated volume, and then what were the causes, so relevant to sections 2.1 and 2.2 in the document. I should state that, this table is much bigger in the actual appendix, and it does cover everything else that we'll talk about that Mark and Denise and Mike will talk about as we go on. So things like the patent transport evaluation that was done, the analytes that were investigated, how they were investigated, what methods that were used, and also what kind of response activities were conducted for it. So the appendix itself covers a lot of the detailed information for each of these case studies. Again, this is just a snapshot of that. I should also mention those three that are listed in bold, the PNW Terminal or Pacific Northwest Terminal in Oregon, Cambria, Minnesota, and St. Paul, Minnesota, they have full write-ups on them in a lot more detail than just captured information in a table. So there's some narrative behind it as well to give additional detail to it. So moving on to slide 30. Section 2.3 of the document, now that we've gone through and, looked at what kind of causes that we have, based on these case studies, how frequently they're occurring, and where are they occurring in the supply chain, we want to look at, now that we have this body of information, are there things that we can do or common things that we're seeing that could actually be then transferred into how to prevent them going forward? So one of the areas that we do see very commonly in a lot of these releases is the compatibility of materials and equipment. Again, most of the infrastructure associated with fuel was all designed based on the material compatibility with petroleum. Well, ethanol and biodiesel are very different chemical compounds. They have very different physical, chemical, and biological behaviors, and that translates into how they will actually interact with these different components. So if you think about it from a materials standpoint, and an underground storage tank system, the dispenser system itself, and even in an automobile, how many different materials does that fuel contact as it's going through that infrastructure? So every material has to be compatible with it. And again, most of it was actually previously designed for containing, storing petroleum-based fuels. So now all of a sudden you're introducing this biofuel. Not all of them are necessarily going to be compatible. So the different plastics, polymers, and elastomers that are used, metal components, and even the solders used in different components can actually be incompatible with the biofuel. I had already mentioned earlier in one of the previous slides about leak detection equipment. Some of them just simply weren't designed to handle a biofuel compared to a petroleum fuel. So they may not actually be able to detect the leak occurring just simply because they weren't designed that way. I should mention there's actually been a ton of work done in materials compatibility. Since we started seeing a lot of these releases in biofuels, and in fact, there's a series of documents that have been published either by the Office of, USEPA's Office of Underground Storage Tank. Oak Ridge National Lab has published a document, and the Association of State and Territorial Solid Waste Management Officials, or ASTWAMO, has also published some documents on this as well, looking at different, materials compatibility issues associated with it. Some deal with strictly, high concentration fuels, some E15 and higher. Others, compatibility with, different types of biofuels, biodiesel, ethanol, and so forth. I believe Juliana will list these references at the end of the talk as well. So moving on to slide 31. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't finish slide 30. The other major category of release prevention that we're seeing is simply the management practices that are associated with dealing with maintaining the infrastructure, maintaining the fuel dispensing system, the underground storage tank, the ASTs, the mixers, the blenders, and all the equipment that's associated with the fuels themselves. And mainly, again, because, these biofuels do behave differently and they're going to interact differently with all these pieces of equipment, you actually need to adjust your management practices to deal with that as well. So, one of the examples that we talk about quite a bit is the fuel filters, for example, that are in dispensers right now. Typically they're used to keep the fuel clean before it's dispensed into the vehicle. Well, for example, biodiesel has a very different chemical properties, if you will, than regular diesel. And in fact, it goes through a different different temperature changes associated with it. So typically when you put it into the ground in an underground storage tank, it's going to be at a certain temperature, but when depending on the climate that you're in, it could actually be affected by the atmospheric temperature, as well as when you pump it up above ground, it's going to change the temperature as well. And that change in temperature, biodiesel is much more susceptible to temperature changes and compositional changes associated with the temperature change than regular diesel. So for example, if you rapidly change the temperature of a biodiesel, oftentimes you'll get this small precipitate matter settling out from the fuel. And it's really impurities left behind in the processing, glycerols or some other chemicals that are associated with the processing of biodiesel that form this precipitate. Well, that's clogged your filter much faster than the regular petroleum-based diesel would have. So if you don't change that, filter out more quickly through your management practices, you're going to lead to clogged dispenser lines and actually lead to potential releases because it's back pressuring into the system and so forth. So again, you just need to be able to adjust your management practices, knowing that now you're actually dispensing a different fuel than the petroleum-based fuel. We do have a checklist, Appendix B, that kind of goes through the compatibility of a UST system for accepting new biofuels. So, for example, there's a red star because of our case study that we'll be talking about in more detail as we go. if you have a regular underground storage tank system and a dispensing system that you want to take from a conventional fuel over to a biofuel, you need to go through this checklist to figure out, okay, is it still compatible? Do my materials, are they compatible with this new fuel? Are my management practices still compatible with, managing this this new fuel that I'm doing? And in the terms of the hypothetical case study, this checklist was not done. So it didn't go through that, and it actually led to the release that we'll be talking about. Okay, now moving on to slide 31, the emergency response planning. This is section 2.4 in the document. And really, this is talking about the different spill prevention, control, and countermeasures, or SPCC plans, required for certain facilities carrying, a certain volume of fuel, as well as facility response plans, which, again, is based on the amount of fuel storage that is being done at the site. So a facility response plan is more going to be for your supply terminal, where you have typically a million gallons or more of a particular fuel that you're storing, as opposed to an underground storage tank site, which, is not going to have that level of volume. But we do talk about, how do you adjust your spill response plan in this section of the document, mainly talking about compatibilities again. How compatible is this new biofuel that you're, either storing or dispensing at your site with firefighting foams or sorbent booms that you may have to deploy on a waterway if there is a release at your terminal facility and so forth. And because, again, these things behave differently, you have to adjust your plan. So, as Denise will mention in her part, there's a much higher oxygen demand associated with biofuels than with the petroleum. And when you have a high oxygen demand, you can typically lead to a lot more catastrophic incidences associated with waterways. So you want to be able to manage your site differently in terms of whether or not the fuel can get to a waterway or not. Layering on the fact that certain sorbent booms aren't compatible with biofuels simply because ethanol, for example, is 100% miscible in water. So, yes, the oil will float on the water, and you can use a sorbent boom to kind of corral that and gather that together. The ethanol is going to dissolve into the water and go straight underneath your sorbent boom. And similarly, firefighting foams just simply, they weren't designed for it. There are some that are out in the market today in terms of dealing with biofuel releases. And, again, because of how it behaves, it burns differently than the petroleum-based fuel. You need to deal with the fire side of that as well with different firefighting foams. So moving on to slide 32, this is our case study again, and I'll talk, step through what happened in the release. So this particular operator decided to convert a former E10 fuel system, an underground storage tank that had E10 in it and a dispenser associated with it, over to E85 because that's what his customers started wanting. And in this case, when he put that E10 or E85 into the conventional petroleum fuel tank, again, it caused a scouring effect of some sludge, rust, sediment in the scale that had built up and actually held together a tank. And once that high solvent E85 hit that material, it actually scoured it away and led to a catastrophic release. Now, the picture on the bottom left of this slide is an actual hole this incident actually occurred in. And so this is based on some reality here. And again, in terms of, release prevention, I had mentioned, the checklist that we have in the appendix. It was actually not used in this case to actually look at, okay, how long was this tank storing E10 before? Have you done any kind of internal inspection of it? Has it been completely cleaned or not? And it would, things like that would have identified whether or not you had a weak point in the tank itself. So ultimately, when the operator introduced E85, it scoured away this sludge and rust, and then led to a catastrophic 10,000-gallon E85 release. So moving on to slide 33, in quick summary, biofuel releases really can occur just about anywhere, just simply if you think about where are things occurring in the supply chain. So tanker trucks are in, where are retail sites? They're in pretty much every corner of every town in this country. Tanker trucks are moving between supply terminals, which are fewer and far between, but they're actually fairly dispersed around the country as well. and on, you know, major roadways as well as side roads. So that, you know, and same thing with, you know, train cars, you know, and train and rail systems. You know, they're pretty dispersed across the country in terms of where these things occur. So they can occur in rural parts of the country. They can occur in very dense urban populations. They can occur in, you know, essentially in your backyard if you live near a rail line. And the current case study that we've looked at, you know, indicate that, you know, yes, you can have these catastrophic type releases like a train car derailment and, you know, train car breaking open. But you can also have some very subtle ones, you know, so an underground storage tank system, most of it's underground, and you're not going to necessarily see where these release points are occurring. And mainly because, you know, there's, you know, hundreds of different materials that are associated with that underground storage tank system and dispensing system. You just may not see these, you know, small chronic releases occurring, but that, you know, they can build up over time to lead to some major environmental issues. We do have some, you know, because we have these case studies, we do have some root cause analysis, if you will, looking at what are the causes, what are, you know, these material compatibilities, the management practices that weren't changed. Now that we have that information, we have some suggestions on how to, how to prevent those moving forward. And again, we do have some emergency response preparedness. And again, all of this is based on how compatible is this material with your current operations, your current infrastructure that you're managing the system in. So moving on to slide 34, again, this is our training roadmap. And I'll hand it over to Dr. Denise Nelson to talk about the fate and transport. Denise is a principal remediation engineer with Arcadis, located in Minneapolis. And she's done a lot of work in understanding the biofuels, fate, and transport work. In fact, she did her PhD research in this area looking at how the microbial communities react to fuel releases such as this. So, Denise, I'll hand it to you.
Thanks, David. Hi, everybody. Why don't we just move from slide 34 right to slide 35, where we're going to be talking about fate and transport, which is section 3 of the document. And so we're going to start talking about biofuel properties and then how those properties affect surface and subsurface behavior and how that then affects microbial communities and byproduct formation, which is one of the key things that we've been talking about, you know, some of the risks or a lot of the environmental risks associated with biofuels are not actually from the biofuels themselves, but what happens as a result of microbes that are stimulated once the biofuel reaches the environment. And then we are going to talk about what impact the biofuel, so this would actually be about the biofuel itself, if you release a biofuel on an existing petroleum hydrocarbon or NAPL source, kind of like what David was saying, you know, these retail stations are everywhere and sometimes there's been prior releases, so what would happen if you actually release a biofuel, especially an ethanol-based biofuel, onto some of these prior releases. So if we move on to slide 36, I wanted to talk about, you know, the properties of these components. And again, as Mike alluded to before, you know, we have the way we went about analyzing what effect these biofuel components will have on the environment is something that you can use for other types of biofuels that may come on the market. So here's an example of that, and this is table 3.1, and we have a red star on this slide because I just took a couple of the excerpts from that table that are pertinent to our hypothetical case study. So we have ethanol, and then we have a reference compound just for comparison for a more familiar petroleum hydrocarbon compound, so like benzene. And so we look at solubility, Henry's law constant, vapor pressure, biodegradation potential, and then finally on the far right is what do all these things together mean. So, for instance, ethanol has infinite solubility. It has a low Henry's law, and it has a similar vapor pressure to benzene, but it's more biodegradable than benzene, relatively. So the implications is because it will readily partition to water because it has this infinite solubility, and it will dilute according to availability. So if you have a large body of water, it will dilute down available, you know, the volume ratio there. But then it's rapidly biodegradable. In contrast, benzene, because it's not soluble, not infinitely soluble, there's a solubility limit, it will readily partition to the vapor phase based off of that and the Henry's law constant. And then so essentially what we're saying or what we're showing here is, you know, if you have benzene release, you can probably sparge that out of a water. But with something like ethanol, that's not going to come easily out of the water phase. we have a lot more properties of these particular compounds, and then also an expanded list of compounds available in Appendix C for those of you who are really interested in that. And so that's something, again, useful that you can use for another biofuel that may come on the market. You can go through the same kind of analysis. So let's move on to slide 37. This has been discussed a little bit by both Mike and David, but really, what is the behavior of a biofuel when it hits for a surface spill? So we're going to talk about subsurface in a little bit, but this would be section 351 and 352 in the document. So the initial fate, once it's released, it could be vaporization. Again, even ethanol has a relatively high vapor pressure, so if it's not dissolved in water, it's going to vaporize. Ignition and consumption by fire, it can be a significant loss mechanism. But then there's going to be really surface drainage for that isn't ignited or vaporized. And then it will eventually go into a body of water, which would be the surface water dilution. And so one of the key things that isn't discussed in this section but is in section 1-6 that I want to talk about first is, you know, so there could be some immediate short-term impacts on surface water, biota, so like fish, organisms. And so there is some toxicity limits associated with this. Ethanol and isobutanol are two common biofuels. Aquatic toxicity range from about 1,000 milligrams per liter to 14,000 milligrams per liter. Biodiesel, there's not really a lot of data out there on immediate toxicity. But what we found at these case studies and looking at these sites is that's really not the dominant mechanism. There hasn't been a lot of impact in terms of effect on the organisms in the water from a toxicity. It's really the dissolved oxygen depletion that has been impacting aquatic life, so we can get fish killed. And that is a little bit of a longer-term impact, but long being, probably in days instead of immediate. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a few slides, but I wanted to point that out. Slide 38, so now if we're talking about the subsurface, we do provide figure 3.1, which is just kind of a comparison for you about typical petroleum hydrocarbons. And I wanted to plug again, I know Mike did this earlier, but the ITRC, LNAPL guidance and training, there's a lot of documentation and training available on petroleum hydrocarbon releases. So if we use this as our reference compound, if you say have a release, it percolates down through the vatos zone, it's going to form a non-aqueous phase liquid or NAPL body because it's sparingly soluble once it hits that water table, and then it's going to slowly dissolve over time. So you can the dissolve phase plume, that's typically when we're looking at like BTEX compounds in the groundwater. So we know there's a source in NAPL, and then there's a dissolved phase plume. So if we move to slide 39, what's the difference with biofuel? And I'm really going to be talking about denatured fuel ethanol or ethanol blends here because that's where really the primary difference comes in. So if we have on the left here shown in red is the conventional gasoline or petroleum, and we're just going to say E0. There's no ethanol in here. And again, similar to the previous slide, you can have it percolating down. If it does reach the water table, you're going to form that NAPL body. If you move to the middle, it's E10, so this is a lot of our oxygenated fuels where you have up to maybe 10% of denatured fuel ethanol. That ethanol component may not actually make it into the water table because ethanol is so soluble, it'll actually partition into soil moisture. So you're going to lose that ethanol as it's making its way down into the vatos zone. Now, conversely, denatured fuel ethanol, if you have a large enough release where you have enough driving force to get it down to the water table, you're going to have loss of that ethanol within the vatos zone, but a lot of loss, I guess, or a lot of kind of partitioning into that increased soil moisture that's present in that capillary fringe, so right above the water table. And so you can actually get so much partitioning, again, because it's dissolving into the water, that it'll collapse that that capillary fringe because now you've changed the properties of the water in there, and the interfacial tension decreases, so your capillary fringe gets depressed. And then you can get quite a bit of ethanol in this zone, and it will slowly dissolve into groundwater. It's kind of like groundwater rises and falls. So, again, ethanol is really soluble, so we used to think, and Mark will say this, there's no such thing as an ethanol plume because it'll go right into water and it'll degrade really quickly. But what has happened, what we've come to find out, is because of this partitioning, kind of that enhanced concentration of ethanol at capillary fringe, it's actually above a toxicity threshold. So it's at a point where bacteria aren't able to really effectively degrade it because ethanol is used, it's a disinfectant, right? So at some concentration, it's going to be so high you can't get degradation. So I think that's a key take-home message here to be thinking about, kind of as Mark was talking about investigation, as we talk about remedial applications, is you can actually have a lingering ethanol source on at these sites. And I have a little red star on this one because if we're looking at an E85 release, which is, you know, 85 up to 85% of the nature of fuel ethanol, you can have similar behavior. It's a large proportion of ethanol, so it can behave similarly to this graphic. We move on to slide 40. We also talked about what, you know, media might potentially be impacted by, you know, where that release occurs. So this is table 3.2. And again, I pulled out an excerpt from this that would be related to our E85 case study. And so this is really providing, like, what kind of release might there be, what kind of volumes might we expect, and what media might be affected by that release. So underground storage tank systems would be applicable to our case study. And we also referenced the section that David just got done talking about within the document where there's more details on this. So section 2.2.5, for instance, for this particular one. And so we're talking about if we have a release here, we're probably going to impact the backfill and kind of the soil in the UST pit. And then you may have a groundwater impact depending on, again, the volume of release and really that depth to groundwater is going to be a big factor to be considered. And then, as I alluded to earlier, if groundwater is impacted, we may, you know, previously impacted with, like, LNAP, if you already have free product at underneath this pit, there could be some co-solvency issues that can occur. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit. But this is just to give you an idea of where release may occur in the system and what media might be impacted. So there's more information on Table 3.2 in the document. We move on to slide 41, biochemical oxygen demand, or a lot of times we call it BOD. This is in section 3.3.2.2, and this is talking about the, you know, more, I guess, impactful effect that can have from a biofuel being released into the surface water. So ethanol and other biofuels, biodiesel too, are a really good food substrate for bacteria. So if you add it, if it reaches the surface water, it's going to stimulate a lot of microbial growth. And as those bacteria are stimulated and grow, they're going to consume oxygen and other electron acceptors. So for surface water, oxygen is of critical importance because if the oxygen within the surface water, dissolved oxygen, drops below a critical threshold, you'll start seeing fish killed. And so that is something that, you know, has already been talked about previously, but is one of the biggest impacts that we're seeing with the biofuel release that makes it to surface water. In groundwater, because groundwater is not going to get more, you know, kind of easily recharged with oxygen because it's not traveling in contact with this surface, might, you know, be flowing over riffles and getting reoxygenated. In groundwater, we're going to go anaerobic. So after oxygen is consumed, other electron acceptors will be consumed by bacteria like nitrate, iron, sulfate. And what happens is progressively that redox environment is going to get more and more reducing. And that has a different risk associated with it when we're talking about subsurface. So if we move on to slide 42, this is biofuel degradation figure 3-2, and we're talking about anaerobic systems here. So if we have ethanol, this is kind of the breakdown products, and it's a little bit of a busy diagram here, but the things in pink are more like internal microbial processes, so you don't have to pay attention to that as much as the dark blue. So ethanol, when it undergoes fermentation under anaerobic conditions, can form quite a few different products. It can result in hydrogen, acetone, acetate, butanol, butyrate. So ethanol itself isn't going to break down and form methane, but what happens is it breaks down into compounds like hydrogen acetate that can be used by organisms called methanogens to actually generate methane. So they'll use the breakdown products and produce methane. And so in subsurface environments, that's the risk that we're seeing as a result of biofuel release, is this increased production of methane that can cause a potential explosive risk. If you move on to slide 43, one thing I wanted to iterate is this is not like you add it, you add ethanol into the groundwater and you get methane generation instantaneously. There are a few things that come to play. So, one, if we have greater than 6 to 10% by volume ethanol, then that's not going to, you know, there can be inhibition that can occur. So, again, up in that capillary fringe, you can have ethanol. If you have up to 95% ethanol that's released, you may very well have greater than 6 to 10% ethanol in that capillary fringe. But the stuff that's dissolving in the groundwater, kind of on the fringes that dilute down, that will undergo biodegradation. So then it's going to have to go through oxygen, will have to go away, then nitrates, and iron, manganese, sulfates, and finally you can get down to the reducing conditions where methanogens are going to thrive and be able to compete. And so there, you know, how much of these different available electron acceptors are present will depend on how quickly both the ethanol is getting degraded and then at what point methanogenesis will occur. And then nutrients can affect how fast things break down, and then obviously the pH. If you're outside optimal, between a pH of 6 and 8, if you have too low or too high the pH, that can really slow things down and kind of slow this process down. I did want to point out that, if you recall from the previous slide, ethanol can break down into volatile fatty acids like butyrate and acetate, and those can, if, you know, the conditions are right, cause the pH to, you know, become lower in that zone. So, again, that could kind of slow things down. So let's move on to slide 44 and talk a little bit about methane, because we keep talking about methane being a potential explosive risk. Well, why is that? So on figure 3-4, we have a diagram that shows percent oxygen on the y-axis and methane percent on the x-axis. And you can see there's a lower explosive and an upper explosive limit in the range of where you have oxygen present. And so we call the lower explosive limit, LEL, is 5% by volume in atmosphere, and the upper explosive limit, or the UEL, is 15% in atmosphere. And that's shown bounded in that red component of the chart. So you can actually calculate using Henry's law. If you have a vial of water that's closed and you have some headspace in it and water in it, and you have 5% by volume of methane in the headspace, the equivalent concentration in that that's dissolved in the water will be between 1 and 2 milligrams per liter. So it's really depending on temperature, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide. But so if you have 1 to 2 milligrams per liter, conversely, if you look at groundwater dissolved methane and you have between 1 and 2 milligrams per liter in there, you may have a condition where you could get an explosive, the lower explosive limit. As Mark will talk about in the next section, I mean, these ethanol release sites, you can have saturated methane concentrations, so, you know, excess of 20 milligrams per liter. So it's just something to be keeping in mind. There's some attenuation that can occur in the vadose zone that absolutely can decrease, you know, the risk that you would see elevated methane in the vadose zone, but it's something to be aware of. So when we're investigating sites, we're taking into account this risk and evaluating it appropriately. Again, Mark will touch on this quite a bit in the next section. So if we move on to slide 45, we also show that relationship between temperature and soil gas concentrations. This is figure 3-3. So if we look at the percent soil gas on the y-axis and the dissolved methane, so what's in groundwater, on the x-axis, and we look at the different temperatures. So blue line is that bottom line, that's 45 degrees Fahrenheit. That'd be something kind of typical for here in Minnesota, versus that red line of temperature if you have a groundwater temperature 70 degrees Fahrenheit, which might be something like in Florida. And let's say we have 10 milligrams per liter of methane dissolved in groundwater. So at 45 degrees Fahrenheit, that would equate to about 20% by volume in the soil gas. Conversely, in 70 degrees Fahrenheit, that could be like 40% soil gas. So it's really important just to note that that partitioning is going to be affected by temperature. So, you know, covering the rest of the material on that slide, you know, we talked about previously, but methanogens, use the acetate and hydrogen that's coming off of that ethanol fermentation, and then that's going to be produced in the groundwater, and then there will be partition between the groundwater and soil gas. And, again, this isn't going to happen instantaneously. This can take months to even years before you get to methane production because of all those factors I talked about before. You know, temperatures, if it's low temperature, it'll be slow. If you're limited for nutrients, but really it's going to be a function of, I think, dominantly, like, what kind of electron acceptors have to be kind of processed before it gets to a point where methane production is showing. And then the last bullet is really important. Methane spill gas can go undergo attenuation in the vadozone. So if you have a pretty aerobic, sandy vadozone, there are organisms called methanotrophs. Troph means to eat, that will actually consume methane. So you can have consumption of methane in the vadozone. You can have dilution of methane. So it isn't saying that if you have dissolved concentrations above 2 ppm in groundwater that you're going to have a risk. It's just that you could potentially have a risk, and that's something to evaluate. So let's move on to slide 46. Preferential biodegradation of biofuels over contaminants of concerns, which a lot of times is talked about, like the BTEX compounds. This is in section 343 and 344. So there was a lot of research done kind of in the early days about, hey, if you have benzene and ethanol present, you know, data would show that the ethanol is going to go away before the benzene does if you have a microbial culture present. And so, therefore, the concern is if you have an ethanol release either on an existing site or, because these are fuel mixes, if you have ethanol along with BTEX, let's say, you know, your ethanol is going to go away, so that means you might have a plume elongation for the BTEX. So this has been looked at a little bit more in depth, and so while this, you know, I don't think anybody's ever actually demonstrated that all of a sudden our plume went much longer, but it's been done in controlled settings that say yes, and modeled. But yes, plume elongation can occur, but it's gonna be really temporary. And actually, it might be a shorter lifetime associated with the plume because you have a lot of readily degradable carbon food substrate for bacteria to utilize. So you're gonna grow up a really pretty dense microbial culture in your subsurface. And then once the ethanol is gone, then you have a lot more bacteria available to do the work and degrade the petroleum components that are present. So that's just something that's been looked at, and so I just wanted to point that out there. So if you hear that plume elongation can occur, yes, but in the whole scheme of things, actually your plume actually might have a shorter lifespan associated with it because of the extra food substrate. And one last bullet on here that's really section 344 that I just wanted to touch on. It's as these bacteria are degrading the food substrate and you're going through these electron acceptors like, you know, nitrates, then you can get iron and manganese, and these are redox-sensitive metals, and same thing with arsenic. So you may have a temporary release of metals just because you're reducing them and making them soluble. And so you can have changes in the mobilization of metals, and typically that's just going to be where that food substrate is, and once those dissolved metals leave where the reducing conditions are, they're going to precipitate back out. But I did want to point that out, and you can read more about that in section 344. On slide 47, the enhanced solubility of petroleum, this is section 341. So biofuels, particularly the alcohol-based ones and ethanol in particular, can act as a co-solvent. So if you have, but there's a threshold. So if you have over 20% by volume ethanol, then really your water is not really water anymore. It's this co-solvent mixture. And that means that petroleum hydrocarbons will have a changed solubility limit, and it's going to be more elevated. So now you can dissolve more petroleum into that body that has 20% by ethanol. This may occur mainly in the capillary fringe, or if you have a release on top of an El Napo body that's sitting on top of the water table. It's really unlikely to occur in groundwater because of dilution and biodegradation. I have not personally seen ethanol in groundwater that's above 20% by ethanol. So I think that, you know, it can theoretically act as a co-solvent. You may, if you have a release on top of an existing or residual NAPL, you may see a spike of BTEX, and then it would go away relatively quickly. But again, it's unlikely to have a sustained effect in groundwater itself. But you can, again, mobilize pre-existing residual separate phase hydrocarbons. So we wanted to mention that. That's in section 342, you know, on how that mechanism can occur. If we move on to slide 48, coming back to our case study, our hypothetical case study, we talk about phaeton transport. So, you know, David talked about how we have scouring and there was a release of E85. So in this particular, you know, if we have a large enough volume, which at this site we did, the media that was impacted was the UST pit, but then also the vadozone down into the groundwater table. And again, the capillary fringe connect is a lingering source area for the ethanol as it would for E85. So the risk, now that we know this, is a conceptual site model, the risk is that groundwater will become anaerobic and we could potentially lead to methane generation and potentially sustained methane generation as a result from that. If we move on to slide 49, summary of the fate and transport, really understanding those property differences between biofuels and petroleum fuels are really, really important because it influences fate and transport and really the microbial processes associated with that, which is really key for ethanol in particular because that's what's driving the risk, the dissolved oxygen depletion in surface water and the potential for methane generation in groundwater. So these highly soluble biofuels like ethanol will readily partition into water. We'll talk a little bit about what can you do to remediate that in a couple more sections here. But they're very biodegradable, and that can significantly impact dissolved oxygen concentrations. I wanted to point out again that ethanol can be retained in the capillary fringe. So it can be a lingering source. Co-solvency effects are likely going to be limited to that capillary fringe and kind of the larger, higher releases with a higher proportion of ethanol like E85, E95. You do have a potential for significant methane generation, so something to be aware of. And, you know, while there can be elongation of plumes for, you know, talking about the petroleum components, we expect that to be really temporary. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Juliana for the Q&A session number one.
Thank you, Denise. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute your phone using #6 to ask a question out loud. And, of course, everyone is welcome to use that orange question mark at the top of the screen to send in a question. Also, I'll remind you at this point, if you do have to leave before we wrap up today, please take a few minutes to fill out the feedback form. We have a link to the feedback form on the last slide, and we do use the information that you provide and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. Do you have any questions to start from the phone line audience? We have a simulcast question that relates to ULSD, ultra-low sulfur diesel. The coffee grounds problem with filters in the ULSD is happening at both non-biofuel ULSD and B5 ULSD. The problem seems to be in transporting gasoline in tanker truck compartments, then switching the next load to ULSD. Do the trainers have similar experiences?
David, do you have any insight on that one?
Sorry, I was trying to unmute and trying to think of the answer to this question. I mean, a common issue with actually transporting any fuel is switchover. So using the same tanker truck to move different types of fuels and residual being left behind because you never drain completely everything out. So I guess I'm trying to figure out what was the question part of that. I mean, this is a common, I don't want to say common practice, but it does occur out there where tanker trucks will carry different fuels at different loads. Could you repeat that, Juliana? What was the question?
Do the trainers have similar experiences? And, you know, if so, do you have any solution?
Well, like I said, I think it is a common occurrence that is out there. You know, certainly I'm not sure of a solution to that other than, you know, making sure that what you're putting into the tanker truck has some compatibility, if you will, with the previous blend. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, pipelines also have that issue where you get this, you know, you're transporting one fuel, and then when you transport the next fuel, there's a section of it that blends together, and that is actually separated out prior to, you know, moving the remainder of that fuel through into the system.
Thank you. Do we have any additional questions from the phone line audience? We don't have any more simulcast questions at this point, so what we'll do is we'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. That way we should have more time at the end of the training to answer any questions that come in. If you are typing in a question, keep going. We'll try to get to that at the end of today's training session. For now, we'll go ahead and continue on with the next half of our training class, and I'm going to turn it over to Mark Tuso from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on slide 51. Mark?
Hello, and good afternoon, everybody. Let's move on to slide 52, and let's talk about site investigations, more nuts and bolts stuff about how to actually deal with these releases. And what I'm going to focus on here is really what's different from a typical petroleum release. So we're going to cover risk drivers with the emphasis on some of these new risks, monitoring, analytical methods, and at the end we'll touch on some site closure considerations for these sites. So let's move on to slide 53. Some of these new risk drivers for site investigation, as Denise pointed out, for surface water, the big issue is the solubility of ethanol. Once it hits surface water, it's gone. You're not going to get it back. For biodiesel, since it floats on a water table like any other L-NAPL, it can be recovered. And part of the problem with ethanol is this dissolved oxygen depletion. It's sort of equivalent to a giant release of sewage. So basically, it removes all the oxygen out of the water and obviously kills fish and causes all kind of problems with that. But perhaps the greatest new risk is actually an evadostone, and that's due to this increased methane production. And I just want to reiterate that methane has no odor, so it has no warning properties. There's also potential increased risk for vapor intrusion. That has to do with the fact that you've got this methane and carbon dioxide basically bubbling out of groundwater. Actually, you can strip VOCs, or theoretically can strip VOCs, and also you can develop pressure gradients where you can move it places where you wouldn't expect. I'll talk more about that in a bit. Groundwater, there's really not that not that significant of a risk. I mean, there's, like Denise pointed out, there's a temporary risk due to plume elongation, which may or may not be a big deal. But biofuels can actually produce taste and odor issues in drinking water supplies. That's probably one of their biggest issues with groundwater. However, that may not be regulated. Moving on to slide 54, I just wanted to build a slide in here to show that bad things can happen even on a perfect summer day. This is a tanker truck coming out of an ethanol plant with E95. It rolled over. I guess the driver wasn't paying attention. Just to the left of that guardrail is a very important trout stream in southeast Minnesota. And fortunately, the fire department was about 2 miles away and were able to put some sand down and keep that out of that that trout stream and prevent a major disaster. All right, slide 55. Here's our case study, hypothetical case study once again. And I just want to point out that for these situations, the receptors are usually the same as a typical petroleum release, but the risks may not be. So our site investigation of a recent E85 release from UST, the strategy is dependent on the age, volume, and composition of the release. And age is kind of an important one here, too, because you don't know, generally with an underground storage tank release, you may not know when it actually occurred. So you don't really know where you're at in this whole methane generation cycle. So the potential risks for the receptors are going to be dispensing station, building, and surrounding residential area. And as you can see, our little ethanol plume is starting to produce methane. So move on to slide 56. So what's different here? Based on Chapter 3 of the TechReg document, and what you've heard earlier is, the different chemical and physical properties of biofuels are going to require some changes to the design of your site investigation. One of those is monitoring wells. Both screen length and type need some additional considerations. I'll talk more about that in a minute here. Obviously, there's going to be additional analytical parameters. There's going to potentially be some additional vapor risk assessment for VOCs and methane if receptors are present. And this time factor, longer monitoring duration might be needed to actually assess risk, especially if you don't know when the release was when it occurred. Okay, slide 57, methane, how to monitor for methane. One of the key points you just heard earlier was biofuels have the potential to generate significantly more methane than petroleum. And I like to say this is the good news and bad news about biofuels. The good news is they're degradable. The bad news is they're extremely degradable. And it's not really the concentration that's the issue, it's really the flux. Some of the rates we've measured at one of our case study sites, the methane generation rate was approximately the same as a municipal solid waste landfill. So you've got very high methane being generated. This can actually cause issues with, like I said before, you can move things around where you didn't necessarily think it could happen before with petroleum. So one of the first things you want to do for one of these releases is you most likely want to evaluate initial conditions to see if explosive conditions exist in or near your receptors. Methane appearance, in addition, may not be immediate, suggesting that extended monitoring is needed. In other words, just because you don't have methane now, it doesn't mean you won't have methane in the future. And, in addition, you may actually find methane without ever detecting the source biofuel. That's partly a monitoring artifact, and I'll show you a good example of that in a minute here. In the subsurface, methane can be sampled in soil gas probes or vapor points, like any other VOC, and in groundwater, it's pretty much the same. Okay, let's move on to slide 58. What we found out from our case studies is, in general, it's easier, more reliable to monitor for methane in groundwater than it is in soil gas. Soil gas obviously has some issues related to weather and things like that, but it's pretty stable in groundwater. And if it's in groundwater, you can generally believe it's probably going to be in soil gas to some extent. The length of your well screens is definitely going to affect the concentration, so shorter is better. And you have to be really careful how you collect your methane groundwater samples, too, because it's very volatile, so you can lose it quite easily. And if generally, if you see levels above 25 milligrams per liter, you're saturated and you're probably going to see bubbling and might make it difficult to actually get a zero headspace sample, too. Soil gas sampling points and procedures are pretty much the same as any other VOC, and ITRC has some guidance on that. And we're recommending that if you have potential receptors present, you put in at least one vapor point in the area just to see if you have any explosive conditions. Okay, moving on to slide 59. Here's one of our more famous case studies down in Cambria, Minnesota, southern part of the state. November 2006, rail car derailment occurred, and you can see two tanker cars here sitting in the low area next to the railroad tracks. 25,000 gallons of denatured geoethanol was lost, and very little of it was actually recovered just because of the logistics and the location and where it was at. So, slide number 60 here. Because very little was recovered, it's made an ideal site to do some research on. So, like I said, a spill occurred in November 2006, and 8 months later in July of 2007, we got out to the site and we installed a few more wells and some vapor monitoring points and whatnot. If you look closely there in the middle of the map, you can see those four monitoring wells that are almost touching. That's actually where the tank cars were laying, so that's actually the source area. So this is methane in groundwater. Groundwater flow direction is up, which is to the north. And as you can see, at this point in time, we had very little methane. We did have very high ethanol concentrations. We had 5% ethanol in some of our monitoring wells. The actual concentration in groundwater there was probably higher. I almost guarantee it was higher. So, I mean, Denise talked about earlier, we probably have ethanol at toxic levels throughout the source area here. So that might be why we're not seeing methane at this point in time. So moving on to slide 61, we fast forward 5 months later, December 2007, and here's our methane in groundwater map, and you can see how much larger the plume has become. It's actually migrated beyond our monitoring well network here. And they didn't do a very good job of drawing these contours here, but that whole middle area there is pretty much at saturation levels for methane. So this demonstrates how conditions can change really fast. And you can see our source area there. I want to point out that all that methane you see to the north there on the other side of railroad tracks, we never saw ethanol there. We only saw methane. I believe you saw acetate there as well, but the ethanol, it doesn't go very far before it degrades into something else. In addition, we also put some surface samplers here, basically inverted buckets. And in the fall of 2012, 6 years after this release, we had 22% methane in those buckets. So obviously we have an awful lot of methane off-gassing occurring at the site. It doesn't hurt that the groundwater depth here is maybe 2 or 3 feet, so there's not a lot of beta still in there to attenuate it, but obviously we have some very high flux rates. And actually this was the site where we measured the flux rate for methane that was equivalent to a municipal solid waste landfill. Okay, let's move on to slide 62, monitoring for ethanol. Nevada stone is pretty simple. It's the same as any other VOC, and it's actually part of our TO15 analysis, so we already get that. Soils, you can be sampled using standard VOC methodology, 8260. Capillary fringe, because ethanol likes to hang out in a capillary fringe, as we've seen, might be tempted to try to monitor it there. And there's been some work done on that. There was a 2008 report by the University of Waterloo where they actually used lysimeters, but they're complicated, difficult to use, kind of finicky. What we found, though, is that you can actually do a pretty good job in groundwater. It's got to be aware of a few things. And one of them is using shorter mounting well screens and have those screens across the capillary fringe. You'll definitely see ethanol there if the ethanol is there. You've got short enough screens. The concentrations won't be exactly equivalent to what you have in a capillary fringe, but probably good enough. So if you do have this situation and you have some water table variations, you'll probably need to put in some multi-level wells. And I just want to point out, too, again, that just because you don't detect methane, that's not really a reason to not assess for methane risk. So let's move on to slide 63, and I'll give you a good example of why that is. So this is Cambria, Minnesota, same site we're talking about, tanker car derailment. This is a situation in October 2011, so 5 years after the release. And you can see middle well there, MW1, has a 10-foot screen, set rather deep, probably 8 feet in, maybe a little bit more. That well initially had pretty significant ethanol concentrations in it, but by December of 2010, that ethanol just disappeared. We kind of figured there's still ethanol there, so we went about 10 feet away and put an MW20 with a 5-foot screen, and that well is about 2 to 2.5 feet into the water table, so we got 2 to 2.5 feet above the water table across the capillary fringe. At the same time, MW1 is non-detect. We're seeing 5.3 million micrograms per liter ethanol in that well. So, obviously, it's just a monitoring artifact. The ethanol's still there. We're just not seeing it because our well isn't constructed properly. We also took a soil sample from that boring, and you can see the results there, 6.3 million micrograms per kilogram, or about 0.6%. So, obviously, the ethanol's there, hanging out in a capillary fringe. It's maybe a little bit difficult to monitor, but MW20 is a great monitoring point and quite useful, and to this day still has ethanol in it. I also want to point out, too, that this site, just prior to this, this happened in the fall of 2011, but in the spring of 2011, there was some pretty significant flooding. This site was covered, at least these wells, the area around these wells was covered, the surface was covered about 1 to 2 feet of water. You think that that would have an effect on the ethanol? Well, obviously it didn't. It's still there. So that ethanol just kind of just sits there and doesn't like to move around a lot. And these are little... these are somewhat tighter soils. They're not, they're somewhat, they're sandy, kind of silty sand. But certainly the ethanol just kind of sits there and makes a lingering source zone, as Denise described. So move on to slide 64. We can talk a little bit about biodiesel now. Like I mentioned before, biodiesel forms a nice LNAP on groundwater, just like petroleum. It's a little thicker than petroleum, though, so what we're recommending is use a wire wrap rather than a slotted well screen to kind of help it get into those monitoring wells. And in addition, there's a lot of biofouling with biodiesel, too. It's obviously very degradable as well. So the more open area you have, the less chance you have of your well getting plugged by biofouling. Something else is rather interesting we discovered was that an LAF method using a specific laser called a Targos can actually map B100. It actually fluoresces. So pure biodiesel, no petroleum in it, can actually be mapped using this methodology. And if you looked at a cross-section of it or a log of it, the vertical distribution looks pretty much identical to petroleum. So it, you know, all the LNAP behavior stuff you might read about pretty much applies to biodiesel, too. except its viscosity is a little bit higher. The problem with biodiesel is there's no standard analytical methods for it in either soil or groundwater. So we end up using surrogates. And part of the reason is that is the microorganisms there, they immediately hydrolyze flames to fatty acids. And really it doesn't really matter because there's no really good, or actually there's no flame in water analytical method anyway. So we end up using things like total organic carbon or oxygen to demand type analysis, just basically to quantify the total dissolved organic carbon in groundwater. And it works pretty well. You can actually use it in soil, too, if you know the background levels. Generally, if you have a biodiesel release, even a B100 release, you're going to have a lot of organics in groundwater. I'll show you an image of that in a second here. You can also look for the degradation products like the short-chain fatty acids, but a lot of that depends on where the oil came from, which fatty acids you actually have. So you have to have some knowledge of that. So we use these surrogates, and yeah, they don't directly quantify the concentration, but they're generally useful to evaluate groundwater impacts and perhaps most importantly, methane generation potential. All right, slide 65. Just like ethanol, biodiesel produces a lot of methane and carbon dioxide. You have very high flux rates, and you don't have any of the toxicity you have with ethanol. So in addition, like ethanol, you'll have evolution or bubbling, which may increase methane risks and vapor intrusion risks if you have a blended biodiesel with petroleum fraction in it. And I'll just give you a quick back-of-the-envelope example of that. 1.4 liters of biodiesel, liquid biodiesel, can produce 662 liters of methane gas. That's a 500-fold increase in volume. So you can imagine what that might have, impact that might have in the subsurface. Biodiesel is generally considered non-toxic, but it can have taste, odor, and appearance impacts on water quality. And here's me holding up a sample here that might look like something refreshing right about now, but actually that's a sample from a well that at one time had biodiesel LNAPL in it. This is a B100 release. As you can see, it's definitely impacted. It's discolored, and you see it's kind of foamy, too. And that's probably due to some biosurfactants that were formed during degradation. Now, this is interesting because had there been petroleum in this mixture, would those biosurfactants have increased the dissolved petroleum fraction? More than likely, it would have, but there's really not a lot of information on that right now. So, you know, B100 being ostensibly non-toxic, it's probably going to be a petroleum fraction of blends that may end up being a risk driver when you have these releases. However, methane is probably still going to be an issue for the high percentage blends. And I just want to point out here, too, that we're not considering additives here. That's a whole other category. There's a lot of additives. We don't know a lot about them. Some of them are okay. Some of them are not okay. So that's a whole other avenue of research that needs to be done on these. Okay, moving on to slide 66, talk a little bit about surface water monitoring here. And we're primarily dealing with the depletion of dissolved oxygen and the effect on aquatic life, obviously with soluble biofuels like ethanol. This is a relatively new risk, but, you know, it's not nothing we haven't dealt with before with large releases of sewage. Dissolved oxygen can be pretty readily measured in the field. There's a bunch of instruments for that. There's also some... you can also measure some of your oxygen demand and total organic carbon, too, in the field to measure and kind of assess what you're going to have for a potential oxygen consumption loading. Not much field experience with this. We really haven't dealt with surface releases of ethanol here. But this is actually, these pictures here are actually from the Rockford, Illinois, 2009 release. And all these dead fish, there was evidence to support that it was the low dissolved oxygen that killed them. It wasn't the ethanol toxicity. So they didn't get drunk. They all suffocated. But there was like quite a few of them here, 72,000, I believe, that were killed in this one stretch of water here. Okay, moving on to slide 67. Here's a table 401 right out of the ITRC document. It's our field screening methods. And for methane and soil gas, what we found particularly useful was an infrared landfill gas meter. Ours was the GEM model. It actually measures oxygen and carbon dioxide too. It worked very well. One of the things you need to know about this, though, is if you have any other VOCs present, such as petroleum, it will read those as methane. So what we ended up doing was we fabricated a little quick carbon filter that removes the VOCs, allows the methane to pass through, and we get great results with that. You can also use an explosimeter to measure methane and soil gas, but you're really measuring explosive potential. And just be aware, I think Denise showed you that diagram earlier, that it doesn't really work in low oxygen environments. In other words, you may have high methane, and you may have explosive conditions once that's mixed with air, but in your vapor points, generally you're not going to have any or very low oxygen, so it's not going to be very useful for you there. Ethanol and butanol, other alcohols, can be measured with a photo ionization detector. Ethanol's ionization potential is 10.47. Dissolved oxygen and VOD can be measured with field meters, or there's some kits out there for that too. Slide 68, here's our analytical methods table. For methane and soil gas, we use a method called US EPA method 3C. It's also called six gases. Also gives you oxygen and carbon dioxide. And this is a method that correlated very well with the GEM meter, the infrared landfill gas meter. So I feel pretty confident that our GEM meter, if used properly, would work quite well. But we also verified it with this method several times and didn't really have any issues with it. In groundwater, dissolved methane is analyzed using a method developed by EPA called RSK-175, and I believe a lot of laboratories are actually doing this now. If you choose to do acetate in groundwater, that's an ion chromatography method. There's not really anything standard. You just have to work with your lab and figure that out. For DOC, TOC, BOD, those are general wastewater treatment plant parameters that a lot of people may be familiar with, so those are pretty straightforward. For ethanol, butanol, and soil, 8260B works, and as I mentioned earlier, in soil gas, TO15. In groundwater, 8260B already works. One point to note about it, though, is that if you ask for it and you're doing this as part of the general VOC scan, detection limit's going to be around 100 micrograms per liter. That might, it might be kind of high. You know, that's almost 100 times higher than the detection limit of benzene. Generally, what we found, though, is with ethanol, it's either there or it isn't. 100 micrograms per liter is a pretty low concentration of ethanol. That's going to disappear rather quickly if that's all you have in your groundwater there. You can get a low detection limit if you wanted to use a heated purge trap, but you don't necessarily think that's necessary. Like I said, it's either there or it isn't. So, I mean, that's not a level to be really concerned about. Okay, slide 69, back to our a little hypothetical case study here. Now we know a little bit more about some of these concepts. Let's apply them to this case study here. So obviously, we had a release of the E85 impacted groundwater. It's generating methane. First thing you want to do probably is install a vapor point near the receptor just to check to see if you got any imminent risks out there. Then we can put in some shorter screen wells in the source area and monitor for ethanol and methane. See what we got going on there. You can also monitor for additional parameters, like I mentioned before. You can look for acetate. Obviously, if you have it being E85 release, you're probably going to want to look at VOCs too, or at least BTEX component of it. And something I don't have on here is time. Something that's pretty important too. With an underground storage tank release, we might not know when that occurred. So you get out there and you just take a snapshot of it, and if it's methane, if you don't see ethanol, you don't see methane. Well, you might not see ethanol because you're not monitoring for it properly, and you don't see methane because it hasn't appeared yet. So you're going to want to monitor that for a little while longer than you would anything else. So let's move on to slide 70 and summarize some of the stuff. So as you're probably well aware by now, methane and soil gas is likely the risk driver for high-percentage biofuel blends. It doesn't apply to E10 or B5 or even E15. We're talking have to add significantly more ethanol than that to be a factor. The physical properties alone of biofuels are going to require some changes to site investigation design, such as monitoring wells and obviously something for additional parameters is likely required, and that may require you to either rent or purchase some additional field screening equipment. Additional vapor monitoring may be required because of these high flux rates of methane and carbon dioxide. And as alluded to earlier, all this evolution or bubbling out of these gases can actually strip petroleum VOCs from groundwater and affect these vapors to places where you didn't think they could reach before. This is an area that's actually, I've never seen this. Well, I've seen the evolution, but I've never seen it actually cause any risk from it. But this is an area of, I believe, active research, and people are looking into this because it's certainly theoretically possible. And methane, because it exerts such a large oxygen demand in the vapor phase as well, can also allow petroleum vapors to migrate further than they did before. The people are looking at this as well, too. So kind of the big point here is that do states need to change some of their cleanup policies for this? In Minnesota, we thought so, and we actually have a guidance document specifically dealing with ethanol blended fuel releases, or I should say high percentage ethanol blended fuel releases. And, you know, the ITRC document kind of ends with a statement, if there's any other new biofuels that should appear, the site investigation should be based on the physical, chemical, and biological properties of that new biofuel. And I just want to say for the record here that, boy, when we first got into this thing, we thought ethanol was simple. It turns out it's anything but. All right, slide 71, some slight closure considerations, at least a few thoughts on it anyway. You know, all states are different, but these are some of the things to consider beyond a typical petroleum release. And the number one was, you know, was the site investigation design adequate for biofuel release? Obviously, there's some different considerations you need to make here. Have all the groundwater vapor risks been identified, specifically methane, knowing the risks are greater. Are degradation products still present in groundwater? It's kind of interesting here with biofuels. It's not really the biofuel that's the risk. It's the degradation products that are the risk. So you need to pay attention to that. And probably, as I mentioned earlier, too, pretty important is, has monitoring adequately accounted for delayed methane generation? So you need to monitor these things longer. Sort of the bottom line is that if your site investigation follows a typical petroleum release, you might be missing out on some significant risks here. And finally, if elevated risks and hazardous conditions exist, remediation may be required, and that may be immediate. And that's a perfect segue into the last section here. So it's back to Denise with long-term strategies.
Thanks, Mark. So Denise again. If you just want to skip down to slide 73, I'm going to talk to you about section 5, long-term response strategies. And so we're going to talk about general considerations for remediation, what are some risk management strategies, and then finally remedial selection if you decide that something needs to be done to kind of enhance the rate of cleanup. And again, we'll use the E85 case study as we talked about here. So if we move to slide 74, so obviously long-term response strategies need to take into account the type of biofuel. So for our site, we're talking about E85. The extent and magnitude of the release, what media have been impacted. So for our case study, you're talking about vadosone, capillary fringe, and groundwater, all of which you would have been able to obtain, you know, going through your investigation that Mark just talked about. What kind of regulatory thresholds do we have for the contaminant of concerns? So for this particular case study, we're saying state regulations are applicable to the gasoline components. There are no standards or guidance associated with ethanol itself. Which is the case in a lot of states, but not here in Minnesota. Last, what are the risks to identified receptors? In this particular case study, we have the dispensing station building, and we also have the surrounding residential area to be considered. So let's move to slide 75. We have figure 5.1 in the document that provides a generalized framework for how you would approach this. I do want to caveat saying that every state has specific guidance, so we just want to provide the generalized framework and to always work within your state's guidance and regulations. So we start with the yellow box at the top here, which is developing that site conceptual model and site characterization, which we covered in sections 3 and 4 of the document. And then the first question we say, are we above a regulatory threshold and or a potential hazard exists? And we have the and or mainly pertaining to the methane, because you may not be above a regulatory threshold. In our case study, it's only applicable to BTEX. And if we're below a standard that would trigger a BTEX cleanup, you might be able to walk away. So that's why we say let's make sure we don't have a potential hazard. And that's covered in Section 5.1. And if you don't have a potential hazard and you don't have a regulatory threshold, you can be done. But let's say you go on and say, yes, we've identified that there is a risk, and then you can ask the question, is that manageable or acceptable with controls? Because in some states and some places, you might be able to do something like an engineering control, like you put a subflat depressurization system on the, sensitive receptor, and then you're managing the risk. So then you might be able to go right into implement closure monitoring controls, and you might be able to be done with your site at that point. If not, you can trigger on over to the active remedy. And so next to each of these boxes, we have what section is addresses each of these questions. And then you would operate that remedy until you get to the end point. So let's move on to slide 76, where we're talking about risk management. This is section 5.2.1, and table 5.1 we have in here. And it's really talking about managing risk through long-term monitoring, and that may include some sort of control, which would protect whatever receptor might be have a risk when it's being exposed to contaminant. And a lot of times that is, when we're talking about subsurface and methane risk. So we have the table that talks about benefits and limitations of going with a risk management strategy, again, with long-term monitoring. The benefit is obviously these biofuels are, as we talked about, very biodegradable and without additional enhancement, so they will go away over time. So then there's some limitations that we've talked about throughout this training. Let's move on to slide 77. So, in the flow chart, we've said, okay, we've looked at it, and we really we're not acceptable risk with control, so we really want to look at technology. So what kind of technologies might be applicable? So we have tables 5.2 and 5.3, and I'll show an excerpt of that on the next slide. But these are talking about active remedies that you're going to go in, and you're going to actively try to eliminate, reduce the remediation driver. We've divided them into soils and sediments technologies versus groundwater and surface water. So table 5.2 for soils and sediments, table 5.3 for groundwater and surface water. And we've categorized these as being ex situ or in situ, so you're doing above ground treatment or in ground treatment or in place. And then we further subdivided each category by the dominant remedial mechanism. So for instance, is it a biological remedy? It's something that's going to act upon a biodegradation mechanism. Or is it a chemical remedy where we're going to add a chemical to oxidize it? Or is it a physical remedy, something like soil vapor extraction, where you're really trying to enhance the physical properties of that compound? And we do decide, provide a discussion similar to the previous table on benefits and limitations of each technology. So moving on to slide 78, little red star, because this would be something we could look at for our case study. And we're looking at an excerpt from table 5.2. So we're looking at soil, so zetostone, capillary fringe area. And so there's a couple in situ treatments we could look at. One could be looking at physical removal mechanisms by soil vapor extraction that will remove readily strippable compounds or things with a high vapor pressure. Again, if they're mostly pure phase, like we can remove ethanol, we can remove VTEX. Another thing it can do, which is more kind of on the biological side, is it's also going to promote aerobic biodegradation of biofuels and methane oxidation, which I'll talk about later, because you're basically pulling oxygen into the zetostone. The limitations, again, it's not effective for constituents of low Henry's law constant, so if it's stuck in the capillary fringe, you're not necessarily going to be able to pull that out. And it may require ex situ vapor treatment if, you're going to cross over a threshold that would trigger further mitigation of the airstream based off a permit. So, and then you can look at biological. What if we wanted to do bioventing, so really low flow rate? You can look at basically enhancing the aerobic biodegradation of the compound. So the benefits, limitations in here. So that's what we initially had pulled together. And then when we went to the document review, we found a lot of people who liked that. But then there's some people who really wanted additional details so they could really do kind of the, again, same approach you would do for an emerging biofuel. So that would be tables 5.4a through 5.4c for those of you who really like to get into the nitty-gritty. We looked at ethanol, butanol, and biodiesel. So there's a table for each of those. And we talk about the targeted environmental media. We look at the specific property, like solubility, Henry's law, and what are the values of those. And then we compare the efficiency of that technology on, for instance, ethanol compared to a reference petroleum hydrocarbon, so something like benzene. I'll show examples of this on the next slide. And then we summarize which compounds, either the biofuel or reference hydrocarbons, favored by the remedial technology, so you can do a comparison. So it's a little bit busy, so we actually put a figure 5.2 to walk through how to read this table, and this is actually applicable to our case study as well. So we have two technologies, the same ones we just looked at in kind of the benefit limitation high view point assessment of a technology. And so we have soil vapor extraction, or SVE, and bioventing as a technology. Then the next column over has a target media. So VZs for vasozone, GW is groundwater, SWs for surface water, and we have an X in these are applicable to vasozone. We talk about the physical, chemical, or biological properties. That's what the PCB stands for. So, you know, for SVE, we're going to be impacting the vapor pressure, and we will also be doing the aerobic biological potential because even though it's really trying to strip stuff out, you are entraining oxygen into the system. Versus bioventing would mainly be on that biological potential. And then we have the values for these properties for vapor pressure, aerobic biological potential for benzene and ethanol listed. And then we say which, you know, on these properties, which, you know, these are favored. So, for instance, SVE favors benzene for volatilization for vapor pressure, but it favors ethanol for aerobic biological potential. And bioventing is just going to favor the ethanol because it's, you know, more rapidly biodegradable. So this will give you, you know, additional details that you can use to make a decision. We also, on slide 81, put together table 5.4D for methane. So this is the same format, slightly different kind of assessment here. So this is like, you know, what, how effective will this technology be, pick it be on either methane remediation or methane generation, what effect will it have? So, for instance, SVE will be applicable for methane remediation because methane, you can whisk methane away. It also can promote aerobic biodegradation on methane, same with bioventing. So if methane present, SVE and bioventing will be applicable, can actually mitigate methane concentrations. And then for methane generation, so vapor pressure doesn't have anything to do with generating methane from a microbial standpoint, but certainly if you keep it aerobic, you are not allowing those reducing conditions to form that methanogens need. They need very reducing conditions to thrive. So if you keep it aerobic, those bacteria, or actually they're actually organisms, will not be able to grow up and you know, consume and generate methane. So you're actually inhibiting it from forming. So moving on to slide 82, kind of wrapping this all up for our case study, you know, we've looked at the release mechanism, we looked at the media that are impacted, we looked at assessing the risk and quantifying that through the investigation. So now we're saying, okay, we are okay with the dissolved plume. We're going to monitor it, long-term monitoring, but there is a risk of methane to both the residential area and the retail station. So we're going to look at applying soil vapor extraction because we can physically remove stuff. We can enhance biodegradation, and it's going to be applicable both to the ethanol and any of the petroleum hydrocarbons that were also present in that E85 blend. So we can always then tack on additional technologies to be evaluated or implemented further on if that groundwater risk goes outside of something that we deem as acceptable. So that is what we're selecting for our case study. So if you move on to slide 83, so to summarize the long-term response strategies, you know, these should really be based on risks presented to biofuel release. Monitored natural attenuation can be viable. And again, you know, obviously you need to go by your state specific guidance, but a lot of cases ethanol is not specifically addressed in guidance documents. So, you know, make sure you look at the risks, and if methane is a concern, longer-term monitoring and or engineering controls may be warranted. And then you, again, take this whole process and all the tables we have in this guidance document, and you can apply that to biofuel, other new biofuels. You can apply it to the petroleum component of the blend, future biofuels, additives. You can go through this process to evaluate fate and transport, remedial selection, investigation for things that may come on the market in the future. So with that, I'm going to turn it back on over to Mike to summarize everything.
Okay, thanks, Denise. We want to move on to slide 85 to summarize our case study. So exactly what did this show us? Well, it showed us how equipment compatibility issues can lead to releases, and it also showed us how biofuels move in the environment after a release and how methane gas can be generated. So the case study was also used to show what to focus on when you conduct a site investigation for a biofuel release, and what are the environmental media that should be monitored, and what should you focus on. The case study also helped illustrate what long-term response strategies and risk management strategies are really most effective. So if we move on to slide 86, in summary, the frequency of biofuel releases is really directly related to biofuel production and use. The more it's used, the more likely it is to be released into the environment. And you can address these releases in many ways with the ITRC biofuels document. You can use it to prevent releases, to get a better understanding of how to investigate releases, and you can use it to select the most effective remediation strategy for your site. You can also apply the multimedia approach used in the document to evaluate releases of emerging biofuels and additives. I know that in Pennsylvania, we use the information from the document regarding the physical, chemical, and biological properties of ethanol to help determine really what we should do about calculating an ethanol standard, and we decided not to go down that road and develop one. But we hope that your state or your organization really finds the biofuels document to be a useful resource and that you'll apply it to all of your various state and industry programs. So, Juliana, will now wrap up things for us. So back to you.
Thank you, Mike. On slide 87, we are going to have about 15 minutes to answer questions. So if you would like to start sending in questions, you're welcome to do that using the orange question mark button at the top of the slide. Before we get to questions, I want to take you to the links page and the feedback form. So you're welcome to select either area of the slide. If you do go to the links page first, along the left, under the Clue and Sun, the third button down takes you over to the feedback form. We do use the feedback that you provide and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback on today's training class. Looking at the links, the first item, download today's ITRC training, that's what's going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what's been on the slides, there's more material available in the notes section. The next item, biofuels, release prevention, environmental behavior, and remediation, the biofuels-1 document, this link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the guidance that's associated with today's training. We didn't have time to cover everything in the guidance, and we do encourage you to review the guidance itself. We do have remaining simulcast questions that we don't have time to answer at times, so we do post those on a website. You're welcome to browse through previous questions. In Section 2, we have some related ITRC resources. Some of these we mentioned during the training class, so these are available on the ITRC website. We also have Section 3 with additional websites and documents. This links page will continue to be available for you as a reference, so you are welcome to come back to this page as you need to use the information. We now want to get to as many questions as possible. So for the simulcast audience, it's back on the slides, that orange question mark that allows you to send in questions. And, of course, anyone is welcome to use that. For the phone line audience, you also have the added option of asking the question out loud. You need to unmute your phone, and that is selecting #6 in our system. So unmute the phone at your location, select #6 to unmute the phone using our system. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience? As we're waiting for simulcast questions to appear, do our trainers have anything that you'd like to add?
Seems to be a pretty quiet audience this time.
We do want to give people who are still typing a question a few more minutes to end up providing a question. I will remind you that we're having a two-day classroom training on elm apples coming up at the end of October. So that is October 29 and 30 in Richmond, Virginia. So if you are interested in a class on elm apples, that's coming up in Richmond, Virginia. You can register, you can learn more about the training class on the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. We're also working on our training schedule for 2015, and we hope to have that available within the next month or so. We will schedule out all of our training classes for our internet-based classes, which does include offering new training courses that are in development currently. We have a training course on petroleum vapor intrusion that we're going to offer for the first time early in 2015 that this audience may be especially interested in. If you'd like to join our mailing list, you can do so by emailing me at training@itrcweb.org. You can reply to your confirmation emails or reminder emails that will also get to me. So that's training@itrcweb.org. You can sign up to be on our mailing list where we'll list registration as it comes open for each of our training courses. For today's class, if you have questions, please use the orange question mark to type in those questions. We do have a simulcast question now. Is there any range of ethanol concentrations that have proven toxic to microorganisms on a site? The presentation stated high.
I can take that one, Denise. So there's been research done on both, you know, pure strains and then mixed cultures, and really the inhibition range is about 6% by volume, which is 60 gram per liter, so relatively high for what we've seen in groundwater. So that's where we would typically see that up in the capillary fringe. So, yes, between 6 and 10% in that range, you're going to start having inhibition and at some point complete shutdown of microbial activity just because it's too toxic for them to function.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. A reminder, if you have not yet filled out the feedback form, we do use the information. I appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.